Rand Paul has written a new book called The Case Against Socialism. But surely this is an old lesson. But however, one of the things he reveals in that, and recent articles and surveys, a new poll from Gallup, reveals that people in the West, young people in the West, are souring on capitalism. Less than half, 45% in fact, view capitalism positively. Meanwhile, 51% of young people are positive about socialism. Bill Muhlenberg has reviewed Rand Paul's book, and he's my guest on today's show, and we're going to delve into the case against socialism.
I'm an anti-feminist because I think it's oppressive, I think it's anti-male, I think it's anti-femininity.
Now, it may be a very weak Brexit, but I tell you what, Brexit of any kind and leaving those treaties as well.
That's the best ever interview. The Michael Parkinson, you got nothing on this book.
Just a decade ago, 68% of young people, people under 30, viewed capitalism or freedom positively. Now it's only 45% and declining. Exactly what's gone wrong? Joining me today to discuss Rand Paul's book is someone who's reviewed it on his blog Culture Watch, Bill Muhlenberg. Welcome to Pillow Talk, Bill.
Great to be with you.
Now, tell me, maybe just give us the helicopter view first. Exactly what is the average young person missing who looks favorably upon socialism?
Well, we could say they're missing quite a bit. Maybe basic education, lessons in history, and awareness of what's actually happening in the world. On and on it goes, but that's really the product of Western education nowadays. We have kids coming out of schools illiterate, innumerate, you know, they know all about sex ed or drugs or this and that, but they know very little about history, about economics, about politics, about the real world. So in a sense, this is a much bigger ask as to how do we deal with this, but certainly in terms of knowing about socialism, knowing about its failed record, both in theory and practice, there's a lot they need to brush up on.
So what exactly are some of the historical examples of socialism? Where has it gone terribly wrong, and where's it gone right, or the best it's ever done?
Well, you could say it's pretty much always gone wrong whenever it's been tried. You know, the left is often keen to say, oh, it's never really been tried yet properly. These have all been aberrations, but, you know, we're still waiting 100 years on, even 150 after Marx and Engels. We're still waiting for it to be tried, apparently. Never mind the Soviet Union, never mind Eastern Europe, never mind Mao's experiments, Pol Pot's experiments, current realities in places like Venezuela. We've had it. We've been there. We've done that. We've tried it time and time again. And sadly, it's never worked. The truth of the matter is, if you're keen on spreading wealth around, well, it first has to be created. Socialism does not create wealth. That's the free market. That's capitalism for all of its faults. It is the master at creating wealth, creating jobs, lifting the masses out of poverty. Socialism has never done that. Instead, the elites will get the wealth and the masses will live in grinding poverty. Again, look at the Soviet Union. Look at Eastern Europe. Look at all the attempts to have the socialist experiment happening, and it's always been an abject failure. In fact, it's interesting, as we speak, 30 years ago, we had the fall of the Berlin Wall. There's your obvious example of that. Sorry, this does not work. It's never worked. The people always fled where socialism was in play. People were fleeing East Germany. They were not trying to get into East Germany from the West. They were trying to get out. They fled the Soviet Union. They fled China. On and on it goes. So we have people voting with their feet. And, we're still waiting to see this pristine example of socialism, which it seems actually doesn't exist.
Now, you've mentioned a lot of names there. I think it's worthwhile noting that what you said about the national curriculum, the standard of education in Australia, the West in general, but we're certainly discussing this in an Australian context, they may not have a lot of familiarity with the history of those names, Marx, Engels, Stalin, Lenin, Russia, China, the East Germany, West Germany. If it was 30 years ago this month when the Berlin Wall fell, and you know, young Americans have grown up in an America, and the rest of the West has grown up in a world which doesn't know about the Berlin Wall, has never heard the name Gorbachev, and Reagan perhaps, and so. It's actually those people who are under 30, who weren't even born when that wall fell. And certainly I wasn't much a student of newspapers and geopolitics at the time that it fell myself. It's fair to say they've got no familiarity with any of this history at all, especially given our education system, which doesn't like giving the history of the West and capitalism and democracy. So perhaps you can detail for us in a little bit more depth what happened in, well, let's talk about Germany. Why was Germany divided with a wall, and what was happening each side of the wall? The contrasts, if you'd like.
Yeah, well, it was the Spanish philosopher Santillana who said, if we don't learn from the lessons of history, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes. Mm-hmm. So that shows the value of history. And as you say, we're not being taught history in our schools, at least not very well, or sadly, way too often in our rather leftist education, we're getting revisionist history. That is, we're being taught history as it really wasn't. We're being taught that communism and socialism were good things, that the Soviet Union was a great thing, that Eastern Europe was, you know, doing good stuff for the people. So that's part of the problem. As we know, socialism has never been voluntarily embraced. It's always come at the barrel of a gun. So the Soviets took over Russia in 1917. Then they started to take over much of Eastern Europe. So we had Germany divided with a wall in the 60s. People were tired of the Soviet oppression in Germany, so they kept going to the freer West. Those in the East, the communists, didn't like what was happening. So how do you prevent the masses from leaving? Well, unless you can come up with a good system that's attractive to the masses, what you have is a mass exodus. They built a wall, not to keep people from coming in, as we think about today and say America, Trump's got to build a wall because we've got so many people trying to get in. Again, the direction people go tells us much about the system. In America, people like freedom, prosperity, the free market that America offers. But in Germany in the 60s, the people were leaving the oppressive, impoverishing system of socialism. So the authorities put up this wall and killed people who tried to leave the East to go to the West. Of course, that finally came down after a lot of internal contradictions in 1989, and that really was the end of communism in Europe, and, well, the Soviet Union itself began to collapse. So again, history tells us what people value. They value freedom. They value prosperity. They value the ability to make their own choices, to make their own money, to spend it as they will, and actually have choices to make as to what they can spend it on. When you simply go into a supermarket, as was the case in the East, empty shelves, you know, nothing to buy. Well, it doesn't matter if you have money. If you got nothing to spend it on, that's a real failure of socialism. So that's some of the kinds of lessons we'd want to remind young people especially of. It's been tried, it's been found wanting, And again, the free market has got problems. Nobody's saying it doesn't. Unbridled greed is found in all social economic systems. You can have greedy socialists, greedy communists, and you can have greedy capitalists. But on the whole, you have the freedom and the free market to be able to make choices, to be able to pick the jobs you want, to spend the money the way you have it. If you're a Christian, for example, you can give the money you're making to a church or a missionary group. That kind of freedom has never existed in the socialist countries.
So I think the thing that probably appeals to a lot of under 30-year-olds is that socialism sounds like the cure to greed. It sounds like the way that we're going to make sure that greedy people don't hoard too much and oppressed people, struggling people, poor people, the less fortunate, unprivileged people don't miss out. That there's actually making sure that there's enough for everybody. It sounds really great. It sounds noble and virtuous. Why is that such a bad way to run a society?
Well, it's a great theory, great ideas. If we could actually get it to work, it would be fine. But again, this is where history comes in handy. It's never worked that way. It's always been the case that greed continues. Obviously, Christians believe that this is something that's in the human heart. And unless you deal with the heart, economic and political systems are not going to change the human heart. So you have greed in communist systems big time. Again, constantly you find the masses are impoverished. They have no wealth. They have no, well, often no food. Famines are a natural part of socialism. But you have a very small elite at the top, the political elite, the rulers. They have all they want. They're doing fine. And their greed is still on display for everybody to see. They have the mansions, they have the wealth, they have the food, they have the luxuries, while the masses starve. So again, the root problem, greed, sure, we need to tackle it. But if you're a believer, you say that's something that's got to be dealt with internally. External structures are not going to deal with the greed problem. So again, it's a good theory. It sounds nice, but it's never worked. And again, if you are concerned about the poor, if you want to see a redistribution of wealth, well, in the first place, it has to be created. And as we said, capitalism has always been the engine of creation of wealth. It's allowed the masses to be raised out of poverty. That's something socialism has never done. I mean, the simple lesson here is this. If you know that no matter how hard you work and labor, the state is going to take your wealth and use it as it sees fit. Well, the obvious point is, why bother? Why spend your time working really hard if you're not going to see the fruit of your labor? That is what you get in the free market. You can work hard, you can earn a lot of money, and you can use it as you like. That is not the option in socialism. So people give up. Why bother? Why work hard? It's pointless to do so. So there's a disincentive to work, and work is a biblical virtue, of course. But in the free market, work has its virtues because you get to see the fruit of your labor and you get to spend it as you will.
I'm reminded by your point of an anecdote that Thomas Sowell shared in one of his books, Basic Economics. And he was talking about the fact that in a socialist regime like Russia, in communist Russia, many decades ago, they realized that people like farmers weren't working as hard because they were paid the same no matter how hard they worked. If they worked really hard or if they worked half a day, that they weren't doing as much work. And so the farms weren't producing as much food and the nation was starting to starve. So they figured, okay, well, what we need to do is we need to make sure that the farmers are plowing the whole field really deeply, because the farmers figure, hey, if I only plow to 2 inches deep, I'm going to finish early, and that's the way I can create more profit. I'm not going to have to work as hard. I'm still going to get paid. And so the crops weren't yielding as much because they didn't have deep roots. because the ground wasn't ploughed properly. And so the communist regime said, right, well, what we have to do now is we have to inspect the farmers' work. So we're going to create a whole new layer of bureaucracy, and we're going to create farm inspectors. And any farmer who doesn't plough his field properly is going to get shot for conspiring against the people. And so the farm inspectors now had a job, and they were paid the same, no matter whether they inspected the fringes of the farm or all the way to the middle of every paddock. And of course, nobody was inspecting the inspectors, so they only measured to the fringes of each paddock. Farmers figured this out. They ploughed the fringes deeply, and the rest of the paddock got ploughed at a shallow level, because human nature is that you will work as much as you're incentivized, not out of generosity or charity or patriotism, but out of what you could call greed. But it's basically self-interest. Nobody would go to work for free, except those people who actually volunteer in charities and such, and probably you and me, working out of a lot of passion. But, you know, there's not a lot of people that are going to, unclog somebody's toilets day in, day out for free. They're going to go get up at 3 a.m. and bake bread for free. We're all doing it for money, for self-interest, and of course, when you read the history, as you have and I have and a lot of under-30s haven't, there is endless amounts of anecdotes and examples of how, whether you're in a socialist system or a capitalist system, people are going to be motivated by self-interest, also known as greed. But what about, Bill, those examples in history and in the current global economy, which advocates of socialism will say are working well? And they will often point to some of the Scandinavian countries. Are those examples of successful socialist economies?
Yeah, good question. And let me just quickly piggyback on what you just said about what happened in the Soviet Union. The result of all that, of course, was simply mass starvation and mass famine.
Exactly.
The Ukraine, for example, which was part of the Soviet Union in the early and mid-30s, millions of people died as a direct result of those policies. Mm. So again, if you're saying, I'm into compassion, I'm into care for the poor, I want to help people, well, you do not want to follow this example. This doesn't help people. It, in fact, results in the deaths of millions of people. But you're right. Often people will say, oh, there's a third way. What about Scandinavia? What about those countries? Well, a couple of things can be said quickly. First of all, they are not socialist countries. All of them operate overwhelmingly on a free market basis. There is capitalism in Scandinavia. Sure, there's varying degrees of government intervention, what we call the welfare state, you know, how much there is in terms of, say, healthcare or high levels of taxation, involvement in industry, and so on. But still, at the bottom of all this is a free market economy. So there's been moves back and forth. Sweden, for example, when it was at its most wealthy and most productive, was at its most capitalistic. Afterwards, it introduced more government intervention policies, but again, it was feeding off of the free market policies that made it so successful in the first place. It's true of, again, all the Scandinavian countries. They've implemented a fair amount of government intervention, but the free market is still working. It has very high corporate tax rates. Even individual tax rates can be fairly high. And it's lived on things as well, advantages like North Sea oil. So, you know, there have been various factors that have accounted for it's what we could call success, economic success, but you would not put it down to socialism. You wouldn't put it down to communism. You would put it down to the free market at work with various levels of intervention.
Okay, a couple of quick definition questions. Tell me what the difference is between socialism, communism, let's throw in there Marxism, And also this fancy word that AOC likes, democratic socialism. What are these things all in comparison to each other?
Yeah. Well, look, often they're one and the same. I mean, entire libraries have been written, especially by Marxists, trying to differentiate between the various models. I mean, Marx and Lenin, of course, when we speak of Marxism, we're going back to Karl Marx from the 1800s. He's the one who really started pushing this big time in books like Das Kapital and so on, arguing that we have to get rid of the classes, the class structure. Capitalism is inherently evil. The bourgeoisie, the working class, they're being oppressed by the owners of the means of production. So socialism was a step on the way to pure capitalism. The idea was to abolish all private property, get rid of all capitalism, let the state fully own the means of production, let the state be fully involved, top-down command and control economy. This, in theory, would free the masses. The people could sit around, go fishing if they like, do whatever they wanted. It was a very utopian scheme.
Sounds idyllic.
Well, sure. Sounds great. But the problem is it never worked. It never happened. People never voluntarily went for this kind of system. So again, as we said before, this is where the barrel of the gun came into play. It only worked when tanks and bullets were incorporated. Mm-hmm. The workers themselves never rebelled against the system, as Marx forecast. He predicted all around Europe we'd see the workers rebelling. Well, it didn't happen. So frustrated Marxists took things into their own hands. And of course, tanks rolled into Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and so on. That was the only way to make this happen. And while all that experiment failed, we do have socialism in action in places like Venezuela today, which is so bad. By the way, it used to be one of the most wealthy nations on earth just 50 years ago. Today, people are eating their own pets. People are killing animals in zoos just to feed themselves. This is how bad there is. Millions of people are fleeing Venezuela. It's a gung-ho leftist socialist country, and it's an abject poverty. People are going through garbage cans trying to find something to eat. Again, we have to study what is actually happening. As to things like so-called democratic socialism, well, again, it's a euphemism. It sounds good. But the only way, again, to make this work, according to the real socialist, is the government has to step in and control the means of production. It has to decide who makes what, where the factories are set up, where people work. And again, the result is always poverty at the end. It never works. So we can put a lot of time and effort on trying to make distinctions. But at the end of the day, you really have two choices. You have a free market economy where people make the choices. What Adam Smith spoke about, the invisible hand, where people, millions of choices every day, as you said, self-interest. People decide, I want to do this. Other people decide, I want to do that. Amazingly, it seems to work. Again, it's not perfect. There's always going to be some inequalities. Well, people are different. Some people work more than others. Some people are more entrepreneurial than others. Some people are more keen to put in, you know, 10-hour working days than others. Mm. Some people are lazy. So you have to take into account human differences. But even with all that put into account, it seems to work. America has been one of the most prosperous nations on earth. The West, for all of their faults, have been prosperous. We've been feeding and helping others around the world.
Yeah.
So somehow it seems to work. So, you know, better the devil we know than the devil we don't know. All these proposals by AOC, by Bernie Sanders in America, by Jeremy Corbyn in the UK to push a return to socialism. Sorry, we've been there, we've done that. Better the imperfections of the free market than all of the wishful utopian thinking, which we're still waiting to see actually work.
I've heard in response to the argument that a lot of socialism apologists will offer, they'll say, but all of those terrible examples in history are just places where it wasn't real socialism. Yeah. We just haven't tried it properly yet. Yeah. And I've heard probably one of the best comebacks to that is, what are your complaints about capitalism, right? Well, it's just because we've never tried it properly yet. It's kind of a silly argument because the best we have is historical examples and real life side by side examples. So, Bill Muhlenberg's written an article. It's available on his blog, and the link will be beneath the description in this video, linking you to a review of a book by Rand Paul, and that is The Case Against Socialism. I haven't read that, but I'm going to read the review and make a decision. I'm probably going to read it because I like being familiar with history, even if I just get the Kindle version or the audiobook. I like consuming knowledge and recommend it. And I guess most people watching my show have a similar interest. At the very least, we're trying to unpack some of that for you here. Another book I can thoroughly recommend for the average Joe is a book called Basic Economics that I mentioned before by Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is a guy, a black American, who's now retired, a very senior gentleman, but he used to be a Marxist. He used to be an avowed communist, terribly infatuated with the ideals and the lofty ambitions of socialism. And then he was smart enough to see it didn't work and look around. And he's written this book called Basic Economics, and he's put the complicated history and language around economics into everyday language that anybody can understand with lots of real world examples. And let's talk about the real world. Let's not get into hypotheticals that may or may not work when we can talk about what really does or does not work. And it's a very fascinating way to see these theories applied to global history. Side by side, where you've got countries like Germany, they had the same weather, the same climate, the same economic opportunity, the same national resources, the same culture. All of the variables were the same. And then they had different types of government. So two good books to really sink your teeth into. Bill, I'm torn. I'm not sure whether we should try and wrap it up here and keep it short, or maybe have a little bit of a chat. But we've talked a lot about the economic implications, but let's spend 5 minutes more and just explore, in a helicopter view, I guess, what the political implications are. What's society like? What's government like? What's freedom like under a socialist regime?
Yeah, well, we can't separate economics from politics. Certainly when we look at socialism, they go together. In fact, the very nature of socialism is state-controlled economy. So it is all very political, and it has to be, where the state basically intervenes in everything, not just the means of production, but where a factory might be set up, if it is set up, who gets to work there, where the money gets to be spent, everything. That's why we call it a command and control economy. And who makes those decisions? Well, it's not the worker, right? The worker who's supposed to be the one that we're all concerned about. It's not the poor. It's not those who are struggling to make a living. Bureaucrats, wealthy, elite politicians and bureaucrats, they decide everything. So in hardcore socialist countries, they determine where you can live. They even can determine the color that you paint your house. It's all top down. Governments decide how life will be run. They think they know better than the average citizen how they can run things, right? I might have my ideas how I'd like to live my life, where I'd like to live, what color I want to paint my house. But the bureaucrats and socialism say, no, actually, you're too dumb. You're not able to really make these kind of decisions. We're here, the benevolent dictators, to help you make the right decisions. We will tell you all aspects of life, how you live your life, where you go, what you do. So it invariably is a clampdown on freedom. You are not free in socialist countries. by definition, you can't be. The government has to decide who's going to call the shots, what's going to happen, where things are going to take place, on and on it goes. So it's for those who love freedom, and I think freedom is a great social good, all believers certainly should value it, simply in the basics. If you want to share the gospel, guess what? There's some degree of freedom is needed to share the gospel, put money into, say, supporting missionaries who want to go overseas to share the gospel. So look, some of the basic concerns of the Christian, all that is effectively taken away from you in socialist countries. Just look at China right now, the great crackdown on churches, the great crackdown on Christianity. The persecution is horrible. Churches are being destroyed. Christians are being imprisoned, tortured. This is what happens under governments that do not allow freedom. The Christian will lose, ordinary people will lose, and the government will decide what you should believe, what you should think. So those are all good reasons why we don't want to go down this path.
We're already starting to see some of those symptoms in Western nations with the government deciding what allowed to believe, what you're allowed to say. Unapproved opinions are being censored, and who gets to decide which opinions are approved? Well, that's the potential for tyranny. It's not always going to be the virtuous people. It's going to be the numerous people, and that could be a very corrupt, very perverted, very flawed set of people. Because again, this is just world history. It's crazy to assume the majority of people are always going to do the right thing. There's many examples in history where that simply hasn't been the case. And so the best safeguard against that kind of tyranny surely must be freedom, small government, big individual liberty. Yeah, that's brilliant. Okay, well, look, just wrap it up for us, Bill. For the average person, perhaps university age, perhaps in the workforce for a few years, what should they be doing to equip themselves for a conversation with a peer about socialism? And maybe there's a big fan of socialism who's still stuck with this all this time. Wrap it up for them. What's the problem with socialism?
Well, again, we simply look at history, learn its lessons. That should be sufficient. Communism has resulted in the deaths of at least 100 million people over the last century. 100 million people killed in the name of this ideology. Between Mao and Pol Pot and Stalin and Lenin. 100 million people killed in the name of a system that's supposed to be concerned about the poor, about the needy, about give everybody freedom and equality. Well, it hasn't worked. Instead, we've seen mass killing, mass slaughter. That should be enough. That should do it. We should be able to learn from history. Or again, looking at current nations that are doing this, where starvation is rife and people are fleeing in the millions. What does it take? Again, theory is good, and we can all strive for, you know, have a kind of utopian view. We'd like to see a good society. We'd like to see fair, equitable society. But a common tactic of the left is to always compare the theory of socialism with the reality and practice of capitalism. Now, look, to be fair, you either compare the theory of socialism with the theory of capitalism, or compare the reality and practice of socialism with the reality and practice of capitalism. That's how you do it. You don't hold up some vague ideal that's never been found to happen thus far.
Really good point.
With the shortcomings of the free market. We can always find shortcomings in the free market. Again, greed is real in any system. But if you want to compare the reality of the free market with the reality of socialism, that's when all of a sudden the lights go off. Wow. For all of its problems, the free market really does look a whole lot better. Sure, if you want, tamper at the edges, try to make reforms. If there's areas in the free market where there's shortcomings, sure, we can work to improve that. But for a whole generation of young people and millennials to say we need to give socialism a chance, wakey, wakey, we've already done that for a century and it's looked very bad indeed. Simply try to ask. You can't ask because they're dead, but ask the 100 million people killed in the name of socialism. So again, we have to really learn what's going on. We have to stop being naive. We have to stop being utopian. We have to be real about what's happening. For all of its faults, the free market has done a much better job of relieving the masses from poverty and giving people a chance to climb that economic ladder.
Yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of people. I know people. There's a guy in my church who served in the army of Hungary back in the days when it was a communist regime. And it was horribly oppressive. And he can't believe now his blessing at living in Australia. And likewise, it astounds him that anybody would think there's any redeeming virtue to a socialist model of government and economy and politics at all. It just astounds him that we've got this prosperity of politics and are eyeing off these utterly failed systems, which are demonstrably destructive to a society. I really like the example that you shared. And it's just a profound contrast of the two extreme socialists and capitalists who want to build a wall. You've got Donald Trump, who's trying to protect a land of freedom from being overrun by a bunch of people who want to come to that system of prosperity and freedom. And then you've got a nation like Germany, which had to build a wall to keep the citizens under a socialist regime in to stop them fleeing towards capitalism as well in the neighboring half of their country. So yeah, very, very interesting. I'm really looking forward to seeing you at the Church and State Summit, both in Melbourne on our tour stop on Tuesday, the 26th of February, as well as in Brisbane on the Friday and Saturday, 28th and 29th of February. Have you got any teasers yet? Any kind of inclination what you might be talking about, Bill Muhlenberg?
Oh, well, there's plenty of things one could talk about. I always like the idea of cultural Marxism and its war on faith, family, and freedom, so I might do something like that.
Brilliant. Yes, I've heard you speak on that, and there's a lot of history there that you're intimately familiar with and able to unpack. There's a great deal of things that will surprise and shock people who are not familiar. And even if you've heard it before, there's always more to learn because the history is unraveling before our eyes, and the invasion, or what do they call it, the invasion of the crawl through the institutions. What phrase am I looking for, Bill? Help me with that.
We speak about the long march through the institution. But
that's the one, the long march. So that's the infiltration, I think, was the word I was trying to use. But so looking forward to that. You can come and see Bill Muhlenberg at the Church and State Summit, as well as Dr. Michael Brown, Senator Erica Betts, Bindi Kolchocka, a whole heap of other really top caliber speakers. The way to get more information about when we're going to be in your city, Melbourne, Auckland, Sydney, and Brisbane, and how to get tickets, dates, times, etc., is on the website, churchandstate.com.au, and click on the menu item to summit. That's churchandstate.com.au. Thanks so much for joining me on Pillow Talk today, Bill.
Great to be with you.
Don't forget, you can subscribe to Pillow Talk and get all the latest updates and episodes, articles, etc. in your inbox. You just do that by going to the website, davepillow.com, and I'll send you an email once a week. I'm trying to do it at the moment with links to all the articles and things there. And that way you don't need to be on social media, and when they eventually kick me off, it won't matter because you won't miss out a single beat. You should also follow Bill Muhlenberg on his website. The links to all of these will be beneath this video as well. You can also follow Bill and myself on Facebook, and I'm also on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And maybe we can twist Bill's arm and get him to do a few more YouTube videos a bit more often. That sounds like lots of fun, and I can't wait to see you in the comments where we can keep the conversation going. And this episode of Pello Talk, as always, has been brought to you by the faithful, loyal, generous Pello Talk partners. Thank you very much, and we'll see you later.